Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to the sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of the sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on Mushing.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert for Mushing, and I am joined by Brenda Mackey, calling in from Two Rivers, Alaska, just fresh off of her Iditarod run. Brenda, welcome to the show.
Hi, Robert. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Congratulations on 26th place at 12 days, 5 hours, 1 minute, and 23 seconds. It has to feel good.
Thanks, Robert. Yeah, it feels very good to finally have finished the Iditarod.
So let's lead up to that just a little bit, Brenda. I know you've been on the show before. A lot of people know who you are. They follow you on social media. You're pretty active there. But give us a really brief bio, who you are, what you're all about, and then we'll lead up to how you got to the race.
Well, I grew up in a mushing family, of course. My parents are Rick and Patty Mackey. I started mushing when I was just 3 years old, and I've just enjoyed running dogs my entire life. I know a lot of people get us Mackeys confused. I always say my grandpa had a lot of wives, so there's lots of different uncles and things. I actually was asked numerous times before this race and after this race if I married into the family. And I thought that was kind of a funny question. Probably not something that would, anyway, I was surprised to hear that question. I've been asked if I'm Lance and Jason's sister, if I'm their wife. And so I guess in keeping my own last name, it has caused some confusion.
With that, Brenda, I was thinking about this before we went on. And of course, there are name dynasties in Iditarod. You think about, Booser and, of course, CV and now Mackey. How many Mackeys of all relations have run in the race? Do you know?
There's my grandpa, Dick, my dad, Rick, my Uncle Lance, my Uncle Jason, my Uncle Bill, and myself. So there's six of us.
Okay. So I think you guys are the most by name. Is that right?
I'm not sure. I've not looked into that. I'd say the Reddingtons are probably close because there's Joe Sr. And then there was Joey and then Ramey and Robert and Ryan and Ray. So that's another six.
Yeah, very close. And I guess if Isaac runs, he will take over he'll break the tie, if you will. So let's jump into, you said you started mushing when you were 3 years old. What was the first race you ever took part in?
It was a one dog event. I think that's how a lot of kids get started, just doing a one dog race. My dog was a dog named Fritz, who was on my dad's winning Iditarod team, but he ate rocks and he had to have multiple surgeries and it kind of kept shortening up his intestines and it had a little hunch in his back. And so my parents built him a little cement pad instead of, the gravel dog yard. And he was my special dog for a number of years. And then I eventually continued on with like the three dog class and the six dog class and so on. But yeah, Fritz, he was my first, sled dog that I called my own.
I know that you are a pretty big time, I don't want to say breeder, but holder of the lines that you have. You take that very seriously. How far back do your dogs go to some of those original dogs in your family, particularly to your dad?
So we have separate lines than my Uncle Lance. We have Brett and some of his dogs, Will and I. But I always keep going back to those dogs that I really fell in love with when I, growing up with them. It was more than just performance traits I was looking for, but their personalities. I really am particular about that line. I would say I'm probably the most passionate person about breeding dogs and keeping details of them in my family. It's just always been my passion. I bred my first litter when I was 13. I really love developing young dogs and training them. A lot of our dogs don't go back to like my grandpa's original lines. Very few, you know, dogs get mixed in through the years. And a lot of our dogs actually go back to Gareth Wright's dogs. He had a line that he called the Aurora Husky. And my dad used to race an Iditarod with a good friend of his, Sue Furman. And she had a leader named Dolly, who was just this fantastic little husky. My dad leased her when she wasn't running the race herself. Rick Swenson raced her. She's a little black and white female on the Monopoly box with Swenson. So just this dynamite leader that she mixed with a dog that Dee Dee had named Elroy, who she bought from Gareth Wright. And Sue and her husband were getting out of dogs and approached my dad with two-year-olds leaders, Cindy and Commander, and came to our house. They were just nervous, shaking like a leaf, scared, but fantastic. My dad took them on a run, and Commander was just trotting 18 miles an hour, just this gorgeous dog. Very expensive, unproven dogs. Bought them, you know, the next year. My dad took them in the Quest. They became his winning Quest leaders. They also took second and third and multiple top 10 Iditarod finishes. I really loved Commander. I actually ran him, and my dad ran Cindy Moore. I ran our yearlings a lot, and Commander was just three, and he was my special guy. So I really tap into those genetics and breed back to him with line breeding over and over again. And he was not only a great athlete, but he was a super eater, great coat, bomb-proof feet, just this amazing dog. So that is the line that I really tap into.
I knew we were going to jump into that, and we're going to tell a dog story about one of the dogs on the race here in just a second. Come to the Iditarod start before. How many attempts have you attempted, I guess? And then let's talk about this year's race.
So this was my third Iditarod. I went in 2021 during the Gold Loop COVID year, if you will, and then last year on the River Run.
Okay, so here you are, up to number three, hitting the starting line. Let's go through the race a little bit. What did it feel like to finally be in Willow for attempt number three and hitting the trail? Were you ready to go? Were you nervous? What was going through your mind as you hit the trail?
I was pretty nervous. I tend to get pre-race jitters. I would say I wasn't really that nervous last year for some reason. I'm not sure why. Will had gotten hurt in January and wasn't able to train dogs with me, so it was really hard to lose my training partner. But I was literally running dogs every other day and minimum 30 to 50 mile runs. So I was, you know, for 6 weeks. And I think that because I was so just running the dogs every day, that helped cool my nerves every single day. This year, Will wasn't hurt, so that was great to have his help. But I was pretty nervous. I definitely felt a lot of pressure, you know, and really determined to finish this one. I had a lot of people say things to me. You know, like I even had a race volunteer say to me, "Do you have good dogs this year?"
Oh, man.
I'm like, oh my, you know, so there's like some pretty harsh stuff. My grandpa had come over last summer, and you know, people have these ideas that they form themselves that aren't how you feel at all. But he had said to me, "Well, you just have to make up your mind that you want to travel across Alaska with your dog team." And, you know, like people have no idea how determined I was last year. I went through a tremendous amount of stuff last year to get to the starting line, and I was very determined, but things just don't always go your way. So I guess you can't always have bum luck. But so, you know, I definitely felt like a lot of pressure for sure.
And of course, everybody has an opinion, especially today on social media. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so you hit the trail and things were rocking and rolling. And we were talking off air. It's been one heck of a winter up here in Alaska. Just the temperatures have been brutal up in your area. I think you said the coldest temps since 1904. So a very long time. I'm sure it was good to sort of just set that aside, all the chores that happen at home, and you got into the groove of the trail, but it was a pretty interesting first third of the race. It was pretty cold, a lot of snow, right?
Well, the entire race was extremely cold, and I would say it goes along with the extremes of the winter here. Iditarod's typically pretty mild in March. You might have a couple days here or there of cold weather, but the entire race was very cold and very windy. So when you're in those first few days of the race, you're in the Alaska Range and you expect it to be a lot warmer. Typically, it can be too warm. It was pretty windy just getting into Squintna, Finger Lake. People were joking that it was like the winds out of Koyuk. Bruce Lee got blown out of his chair in an insider video. So there was tons of wind going into Finger Lake. And I mean, the temperatures that I had looked at in the forecast before the race were like 30 below in Nikolai. Well, we just entered like lots of 50 below. So it was pretty extreme. It was definitely colder than I had expected. So I would say it was a particularly tough race weather-wise and a little bit different for everybody that's used to warmer temperatures in March.
And we're going to talk about the White Mountain stop here in a sec. But when you did the Gold Loop run in 2021, how far had you been on the trail, and what was that first checkpoint that was different for you?
So I went to Nikolai in the 2021. So I went through all the most technical stuff. So I had already seen that and had an idea of what to anticipate. And interestingly enough, so I had sick dogs in 2021, and I was talking to a vet in White Mountain, Greg, who I had remembered from being in Roan that year. And of course, I saw him along the trail this year. And he still had pictures on his phone of dogs from my team that had had pneumonia. And one of the big things in this year's race was teams getting pneumonia all around me. And I didn't have one show up until we were leaving White Mountain. And I was very thankful for that because it was the exact same symptoms that I had went through, but they were treating teams a little bit differently, a little bit, I guess, more knowledgeable, if you will, with the treatment of them. And so a lot of dogs were able to continue with treatment and some dogs weren't. So that was a really interesting perspective. And Iditarod has a fantastic new head vet. Stu was great, but Erica's really good too. And she sent out letters to all the mushers about, what was going on with the dogs. And it was pretty interesting because it was very relatable to my 2021 experience. Like my uncle Jason had his main leader, he had to leave in White Mountain because he had developed pneumonia that was just too bad to continue. And it was just interesting perspective to see those
Yeah.
same symptoms.
With that, you said the vet sent you out letters on the trail or like before the
Oh
race?
no, after
Okay.
the race, to like summarize like what type of illness was causing them pneumonia in dogs and just to go through it thoroughly for everyone's knowledge. It was quite a hot topic out there.
That is very
So.
interesting, how they continue on after the race. Of course, there's a lot
Oh,
of
yeah.
give and take afterwards, and learning, like you said, the knowledge base continues on. Pretty cool to hear about that. So
Yeah.
here you go, up the trail. You make it over to White Mountain. Things are going pretty well, I guess, for all of you guys there. Only a few scratches throughout the whole race, so it looked like a pretty good race, at least from the bird's eye
Yeah.
view of watching it. How did you feel going into there? And then they told you, hey, you got to stay here for a day and a half.
Well, it was a particularly tough run over there. So the trail normally leaves Elam and goes out onto the sea ice. Well, the sea ice went out during the Iron Dog. So we knew in the pre-race musher meeting that we would be going through some pretty good hills outside of Elam and that we would be going over a little McKinley. And so, and I figured that would be a pretty tough run. Yeah, and those hills are no joke in there. They're really steep. The wind was just whipping. Sydney and I figured at least 45 mile per hour. So you're going up really steep hills, sidling, and the dogs are just, fighting through that wind. And that was a long, tough run for sure. And I felt like a lot of the runs were pretty tough with the wind. There was a lot of soft trail. When I got to White Mountain, it was just blowing super hard. And I thought, oh man, this is not going to be a very nice place to camp, for 8 hours because it's so windy. The dogs, it's not the greatest place to rest. But they parked us in a place that was a little bit, you know, protected, and that was nice. And when I pulled in, Eric Kelly, fantastic, longtime friend and race judge, he said, you know, the weather's gotten so bad that we're going to stop the race for 36 hours. And I thought, well, I guess I'm not. I mean, I was surprised, but at the same time, it was really windy and pretty severe. So I'm like, oh, okay. And I was pretty worried about Sydney, who was behind me because we had been traveling together. And you can't really stop and wait very easily for people when you're in those kind of conditions. When I got off the side of Little McKinley and down onto the sea ice, I stopped and snacked and waited for her a while and didn't see her coming. And I thought, oh man, I hope she's doing okay in that wind and those hills. And but I didn't want my dogs to cool off, so I just had to keep going. And then when I went through Golovin, you're on a long straight stretch, and I could see a headlight in the distance behind me, and I thought, oh, that has to be Sydney. And I could see one up in front of me that was Keaton, and then I didn't realize that Uncle Jason was right there with him too. But it was kind of strange to be in White Mountain for all that time. I think there ended up being at least 40 people there with the, you know, the comms people and the vets and volunteers, and it kind of felt like we were all at camp, I guess.
And
it takes you out of that race mode mindset. Not that I was like really, I was kind of in a camping type mode, just going down the trail, but still it feels like it's such a long wait. And then you start running out of provisions because you're there for so long. But there was, thankfully, lots of leftover stuff from the first part of the race or from teams who had pulled out of the race. I ended up getting into Jeff King's bags and, you know, getting some beef and some things that I needed for extra just in case. And yeah, that was nice to be able to use those provisions.
So when you guys are told that, this is more for a fan's perspective, somebody that might not know checkpoint routine and that sort of stuff, when they come up and say, hey, Brenda, I know you're supposed to be here for 8, but we're going to pretty much triple that because of the weather. We're going to close this down. How does that switch for you guys? How do you change like your feeding routine? If you do, how do you change your personal routine? If you do, give us a fan's perspective if you can.
Well, you're definitely going to be feeding a lot more. So in an 8-hour break, you know, usually feed your dogs 2 meals plus snacks. And then so in a 36-hour break, you know, you're going to feed them more like 6 times. So you definitely need to, I mean, you're just stopped and waiting, and you're just keeping everybody fed. You're walking them around and stretching them out, making sure that everybody's limber. And because it was so windy, we kept giving more straw and building up their straw beds so that they would be comfortable, things like that. I mean, people were running out of food too, so there was a small general store that they could go to get just some things. And the volunteers were great. They were bringing, and then the community, they were bringing food for people. And there's plenty of time to dry stuff out. I would say I spent a great deal of time drying stuff out in checkpoints, more so than I've ever done in any other race, which was interesting because it was so cold. But there were sections where you're just working super hard in the hills and you're just covered in sweat. Or I ran into a guy having issues in the gorge, and it was like a 25-minute stop of me untangling my dogs with his dogs. I came down a hill and it was pretty trenched out. It's not a great place to stop with 16 dogs, and they were really hot that night. And I see him and he's in a ball in a creek. Well, we just had the biggest mess. And anyway, so just pouring with sweat. I had planned on going through Roan, but then decided I needed to dry my stuff out because I was just saturated. And I felt like I went through needing to dry my stuff out a lot. And so I thought, well, I guess there's plenty of time to dry stuff out.
So you're hitting the trail and you have 70 some odd miles to go now. At what point did you say, yep, this is going to be the year? And then tell us about the finish itself.
Well, I think that I, you know, knew that I would finish before that last 77 mile run. I was actually having what I felt like, despite the cold, despite the wind and the trail challenges, a fairly easygoing race up until that point. I had a lot of dogs at a big team. I had a lot of power. I had Sean Underwood tell me, you know, you got the fastest team in Iditarod, but I was resting a lot. So rest and dogs feeding like ravenous monsters makes for a really fast team. And I felt like very confident and in a good position with a strong team. I had a female leader come into heat and another female who was going out of heat at the race start that all the boys were still obsessed with. I ended up dropping those two and my team went kind of flat. And so my dad used to say, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't with the in-heat females, because the boys are always going to wonder, like, where did they go if you drop them from a race? But then you also want them on your team. So went through a lull around Ruby, and I would say about to Old Woman Cabin, and picked it up after that. The coast, the dogs really started to come back together into their own. So there's definitely a range of things that you go through. It was great coming into the finish line. It was definitely a great feeling to be there. It's kind of surreal. It's a little bit strange after being on the trail for so long and in your routine and in your mode to just kind of come back into normal life and to, you know, take the dogs off the line and put them on in the Nome dog yard area and just all that sort of stuff. It's kind of hard to come down off of that, I suppose, is a good way to put it.
And you finished relatively early in the day, in the early evening. So it wasn't a middle of the night finish. Was there quite a few people there watching you guys come in?
There were quite a few people there, and Sydney was still in the chute. And so she, you know, also had a lot of her friends and family there. And of course, Fern and Susan, her mentors were there. And I wasn't really paying too much attention, I guess, to how many people were there, but it seemed like a lot. And in that moment, you know, you just want to greet your dogs and get them settled and stuff like that. Because she was so close in front of me, the police escort wasn't in front of me. And so I was going down Main Street and actually changed one of my leaders on the ramp coming off. He got scared of all the people right there. Put another leader up there and we went down the road. And thankfully in Two Rivers, we're used to seeing like having to pass a lot of, you know, heavy equipment, cars and all kinds of things, because going down the road in Nome where there's normally a police escort in front of you, so there's not traffic coming towards you. Well, they weren't there, so I had just tons of traffic pulling in front of me, and I thought, well, this is really interesting. But the dog stayed level-headed, and we got through there just fine.
So let's talk about one of these dogs. You've told a couple of stories so far, but what do you want to share?
Well, I have I could tell a story about each one of them, but I have a really special leader named Skipper, and she goes back to those older genetics that I was talking about, and she finished the race with Will in 2024, and her brother Pilot had led about 700 miles of the race, and she finished in Swing simply because he wanted an older dog up there to go down Front Street and had taken her out. And I didn't have any orthopedic injuries at all in the race, which is pretty lucky because there are some trail sections that you would think, how are dogs not getting orthopedic injuries in this? It's like outside of Finger Lake, there's just giant holes. Between Squintna and Finger Lake, there's just giant holes made by snow machines, and dogs are kind of wallowing and flopping around through the sugar snow. And she got an injury in a tendon in her back leg in December, and we spent months just rehabbing her, and she just couldn't quite come back on the longer runs. She would do okay on the shorter runs, but not quite come back. And it was really in the last week before the race that she seemed okay. But, you know, every day it was just a wonder if she was going to actually make the team. And we had pretty much written her off as being able to make the team. Like, this just isn't going to happen. And that was a really hard loss. And I had lost another leader in the Knick, who was a finisher, who is often my starting leader, and an unfortunate accident in Knick with another musher. So that was pretty hard to lose two leaders, two finishers out of the team. But Skipper was able to finish, and she finished in lead, and she led most of the race for me, no injury whatsoever, nothing came back. So that was pretty remarkable because she had missed quite a bit of like long runs and camping trips and things like that. And you know, she's eight now, so she's the older dog on the team, and she was just fantastic. So that was pretty special.
And with all of your dogs there, were they all bred by you? Did you borrow anything like that?
Nope. Every single dog was bred by us, raised by us, trained by us in this team. So yeah, I realized I had quite a few younger dogs than I had anticipated taking early in the season. And I did feel like some of them, like Will had a much more experienced team when he went, just because a lot of the dogs had finished the Cusco and finished the 440 and finished, you know, the Willow 300 and lots of races like that. I had quite a few younger dogs, and those were the dogs that I dropped early on in the race. They just really hadn't had a lot of race depth. And so just preemptively dropping them just for like immaturity type reasons. Like I had two two-year-old brothers, Jim and Max, and the only race they had did was the Kinnick 200, which, you know, that's just a one camp kind of race. They've done a lot more camping than that on training runs, and they were fantastic. But then they started to like really go after other dogs' snacks on the trail going into Nikolai, where people wet snack. And it didn't matter if they'd already had their snack. They're like almost too good eaters. They just want to eat everything. And I could see some immaturity in them because they'd look back at me like, wait a minute, we wanted to stop and get that snack. And I was planning on doing a run all the way from Nikolai to Tecotna to my 24. So that would have been a 70-mile run. And then I didn't end up doing that because I got all wet and ended up using the dryers in McGrath. It's one of the only places that has dryers. Anyway, so I ended up being there for 3 hours. But whatever the case, I was planning on doing this longer run. And I thought, well, I'm just seeing a little bit of immaturity. They're fat, healthy youngsters, but I'm just going to leave them here. And so that was something I did notice in the team.
So what is next, Brendan? Now that you've got this under your belt, are you planning on doing this again?
Well, probably. Will and I would both like to do it again. So we shall see.
We shall see. We'll leave it at that. And I was trying to remember when I spoke to Will at about this same time after his finish. It was only a week or so after. And I don't know if he said, we'll see. I'm a one and done. This was enough. I'm going to have to go back and pull that quote.
I'm not sure what he said either. I think that we all finish and I feel like we want more afterwards, no matter how tough and challenging it is. I did have one really strange event happen on the trail. And my Uncle Lance used to say, you can't make this shit up, you know, because there's so many weird things that can happen. So, you know, obviously I've used a dog food cooker my entire life, and I had a dog food cooker explosion, if you will, at Carson's Cabin, which is a place that I was looking for on my GPS that Will had stopped when he left Tecotna on his 24-hour break, and it's about 50 miles from there. And so I was planning on stopping there, and I go there, and I'm the only person there for a while. And so you're melting snow because it's remote, melting snow in my cooker. And then my friend Richie pulls up. And anyway, I needed a little bit more water and to make a meal I was going to carry with me. And so when you use your cooker, you wait till your burner goes completely out so it doesn't steam up when you pour more heat back into it. So I wait for it to cool off. I pour my heat in, no steam or anything like that, no issue. I light it and it just completely tunnels up in a flame and catches my face on fire.
Whoa.
And it was really, I could smell it burning. I instantly submerged my face in snow right next to the cooker. And I have no idea, you know, if I've burnt my face off or like, really, seriously, like it was really, really intense. So I could smell the burning. And I'm like, Richie, I just lit my face on fire. But it was just like this bluish gray cloud. Whew, I saw it coming and I closed my eyes, but I covered my face with my hand and I burnt my hand. I burnt my nose. I burnt parts of my eyebrows off and my eyelashes off. But luckily that was the only damage, but it was pretty scary because, you know, I submerged my face and I'm just thinking, you know, wow, have I just burnt my face off? Seriously.
Wow.
And then if I had, you'd be in a pretty bad spot out there in the middle of nowhere, basically, to be dealing with that.
Man, that just reminds me of horror movies that you see, right?
Right. Well, that's what I pictured in my head. It's a horror movie face.
Yeah, because you don't know. I mean, obviously, you don't have a mirror. You have no idea what's happening. Unless your skin is literally melting off in your hands, you have no idea what it looks like.
Right. So I had some pretty good damage on my hands. But now it's healing up well. But, I mean, it was mostly just burns. And the vets are great. Not only do they take care of dogs, but you know, I got some cephalexin and started taking that because my hand was getting infected. And of course it hurt like crazy, but you know, it's nothing you can't get through, I guess. But I got really lucky. I got super lucky because that could have been a lot worse. I'll say that.
Wow. That's a heck of a story. Well, I would like to end on that, but I have a couple of more questions. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So these are a little bit lighter questions than what we just talked about. The first one, Brenda, is your favorite song or artist? What are you listening to?
Well, I listen to a wide range of music. I listen to classic rock. I listen to country. I listen to hip hop. I listen to rap. I mean, I just listen to like all kinds of stuff. I would say probably one of my favorite artists is Fleetwood Mac. And I like the Rolling Stones as well. Favorite songs, I would say I really like Fleetwood Mac's Gypsy. I really like Rolling Stones' Beast of Burden. I wouldn't necessarily say I'm listening to that all the time out there on the trail. It just depends. I just usually pick a genre and we'll listen to whatever for a while. I probably listen to country more than anything else, but it just kind of depends on my mood. I actually was only listening to music a couple times, and that was From Carson's Cabin over to Cripple, and then after that. So only twice did I actually listen to music. And sometimes when you have your phone, it's like down in your layers of clothes, it's not very convenient to change your music. And I was actually not very happy with the music I was listening to on my way to Cripple, because I'm like, good Lord, this is like some, it was almost, I don't want to say dreary country, but just kind of a little bit too, I don't know, slow or something, and not as peppy as I felt like I would have liked to in that moment. I did try listening to audiobooks for the first time this year. I have a lot of friends who do that. And I like listening to it at home while I'm doing chores and whatnot. But I was listening to it on the runners, and I realized, and this is just like a little easy couple hour training run at home, I thought, wow, this is really putting me to sleep. So definitely not listening to the audiobooks while you're sleep deprived, because that certainly put me to sleep.
And just one comment on that. You said that you were listening to the music there after the Carson's Cabin. That was literally right after your incident.
It was. Yeah. Well, you just got to take things in stride. So Richie went inside to take a nap. I went inside to change my socks. And I mean, I was like, well, okay, I got to go. And so I was almost done bootying when Sydney pulled in and, you know, told her where we were at, because she hadn't actually intended to come into Carson's. And so I helped her get it settled in, and then, yeah, took off in the night. It was one of the coldest runs of the race. You know, it was 50 below that night. It was very, very cold and Cripple. So, yeah, just got through it.
Okay.
What else are you going to do?
Next one up, Brenda, a favorite piece of gear that you always have with you. It does not have to be mushing, but it cannot be your phone.
That's hard, because I feel like there are so many different essential pieces of gear. I would say probably my watch. I don't use a watch any other time except when I'm racing, and it's much handier than looking at your phone. Like I say, I have my phone tucked away, so you can just quickly look at the time. I feel like that's pretty essential. I got a GPS that I like a lot this year. It's a handlebar GPS, and I had one that was very similar last year, but this one is a little bit bigger, and so it's, you can just see it a little bit easier. And I definitely love that. My fur hat, I would say that's pretty essential. I actually rarely use a fur hat, but like I say, I was getting so wet, needing to dry out so much stuff. It was nice to be able to put my fur hat on while I was letting my other hat dry out inside the checkpoint. But yeah, I feel like those are a couple of my essential pieces of gear. I carried tons of stuff with me. I had an extra parka with me. I had wind gear with me. I had an extra pair of bibs with me. I had three different pairs of footwear with me, plus extra footwear sent out. So I definitely carry a lot of different things, you know, not knowing what I might need or want or...
Yeah. And
well, you know, for particular trail conditions.
And you've
weather.
Been doing this since you were 3 years old. So you've dialed in your systems as best as possible. Okay. Next one up is a two-parter. What is your favorite trail meal or snack? And then secondly, if you're on a road trip, what are you picking up? At the gas station, at the truck stop, what's your favorite snack there?
So Will and I make a lot of homemade food that we take out on the trail, and we made all of my human food in October. And so I really like egg sandwiches, so just an English muffin with egg and cheddar cheese and some bacon on it. And I really like wraps. So, you know, your hands get really dirty when you're out there. There's not necessarily a place to wash them. So you can just, we vacuum seal everything. You just cut off the top of the vacuum seal bag. Hold it, you know, with your gloved hand, and you just kind of, you know, feed yourself that way, so you're not getting your hands all over it. I like really simplistic foods. I tend to get an upset stomach really easily, so I have to be careful not to eat, you know, a lot of sugar and stuff like that. And so I would say, like, just a lot of eggs and meat and things like that inside of a wrap. We made some wraps that we called Denver wraps, like a Denver omelet, but in a wrap, Philly cheesesteak, burritos. So I ate a lot of that. And then my favorite snack on the trail, we've been using these for years. They're called Pro Bars, and they're high fat and high protein. They're really flat, and so you can just stick them into your pocket. Even if they're frozen, they'll warm up on your body. And I can be pretty picky out on the trail and have to sort of force myself to eat. So I have to tell myself, okay, you really need to eat this bar now so that, you know, you have more energy. And so I eat tons of Pro Bars, and I sent all kinds of stuff out, but there's a lot of stuff that I'm like just not interested in eating, like different types of bars or meat sticks and things like that. And then if I'm at a gas station or a truck stop, well, I don't really drink pop, but I really like Diet Coke, I would say, is probably my favorite on the road kind of drink. I like the purple vitamin water. But yeah, Diet Coke is probably my thing that I like if I'm on a road trip. I wouldn't say I necessarily snack that much on road trips. Nothing's really coming to mind that I would snack on, but.
Nope, all good, all good. Diet Coke is a perfectly respectable snack for sure. Brenda, I know that you're pretty active on social media. Instagram, Facebook, all of that. Where is the best place people can contact you to reach out?
You know, I end up just using my Brenda Mackey Facebook more than anything. I do have Mackey's Alaskan Distance Dog Facebook, but I'm not super active on that. I cross share on my Mackey's Alaskan Distance Dogs on Instagram, and it goes to that page. I just feel like it's a lot to mess with a whole lot of social media, so I usually just post it to my personal page.
Okay. And your website is mackeysdistancedogs.com, right?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll definitely put all the links there. Brenda, a pleasure to have you back on. Again, congrats for the Iditarod finish. Obviously, I look forward to following you on the trail. For guys listening, hope you enjoyed this one. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports.
Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.